ultimate path for those people who want to worship God. Again, you know, laws, when we look at the laws, for example, here in England, when we look at the body of laws that exist, realistically speaking, are all of these laws contrary to Islam? No. Probably about 80% of the laws are right in line with Islam. If you have Islamic State, they're going to be using similar laws. Because the laws either came from the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, or they're laws which evolved out of what they call fitrah. A person naturally feels and understands this is wrong, this is right. You know, so laws evolved in that fashion. But most of the laws, probably about 80% of them, are acceptable. There's some laws which are not acceptable. Laws which says you cannot marry your cousin. Islam says you can marry your cousin. So as Muslim, you don't have to obey that law. You can marry your cousin. Right? So where these laws contradict Islamic law, you're not obliged to obey the law. But where the law is a reasonable law, don't cross on the red, Islamic society has got the same thing happening there. I mean, why are you going to obey it over there in the country? You won't obey it here. I mean, you see, we just cannot go into a just total rejection kind of thing. Anything which is from this society, I reject. No. No. I mean, because this is the justification for criminality. You know, if a brother wants to be a criminal, a guy wants to be a criminal, this is a justification. I've rejected the law, so it's okay for me to break and enter and steal and to rip off and things. This is the law of the jungle, you know. This is that attitude. But I mean, if a person is about, you know, righteousness, then automatically he's going to feel that's wrong.
If the law is a such a tyrannical necessity, pay for water, or some sort of unnecessary tax, not the water rate, for instance, and if someone wasn't to pay that, would there be any Islamically? Would he be, you know, would he be wrong to not pay the water rate? So Allah has, you know, Allah has won the bounties of Allah.
True, but you see this bounty of Allah. I mean, I live in Saudi Arabia, and I pay money for using water because that water is not coming into my tap myself. I didn't dig a hole in the ground and now the water's coming up and I'm tapping the water. If I was doing that, somebody wanted to charge me for that, then it's theoretical. But now if somebody has set up a means of pulling this water out and cleaning it up and piping it and pumping it, and you know, this costs money, this is energy, this is things, you know, this has a cost to it. So for the maintenance of that system, etc., etc., you know, they ask you to pay a fee. This is reasonable. This is not unreasonable. In my view, it's reasonable.
I'm not going to say that. And then how then would that, would it be able to apply the Islamic Sharia would be?
No, you see, a person studying law here would not be studying it from the point of view of applying it in an Islamic environment, because most of that law would not be applicable, right? And the techniques that you learn there would not be applicable, because the Islamic legal system functions a different way. One who studies law would be studying it from the point of view of protecting the Muslim community from the harm of that legal system. You see? Because we need, just like we need a doctor, You know, we need doctors to be able to provide certain services for the Muslim community. I mean, when you have cases that arise and they have to go before court, because they have to land disputes or, you know, legal issues arise and so on, so these things have to be dealt with in the court system, because this is the legal system under which you're living. You know, to just say, well, I'm going to have nothing to do with it, you're going to just allow yourself to be oppressed, things to be taken away from you, you know, you'll be destroyed. And in the end, you end up going to a Jew or to some, you know, non-Muslim to go and defend yourself. You know, so there should be Muslims who are aware of the legal system, the loopholes, etc., how it can be manipulated to aid the Muslims and to protect them from the harm of that system. So the person learns it to that degree. They're learning it to gain their skills to protect the Muslim community, provide a service for the Muslim community. So such a person would not just practice the law and defend any criminal who comes to him. No. He's, you know, a criminal, somebody can't defend a criminal. You know, he defends a person whose rights have been taken by the system to help that person get his rights back. You know, he provides, for example, he will have one day a week or one day a month or whatever, free legal service to this community, providing a service, you know, a direct service in that sense. You know, and as I said, his practice is one, he will not be the type of individual who you'll see, you know, ending up with huge riches, because he's not gone into the system for the dunya. He's gone into it for the pleasure of Allah. So it means that, you know, he'll be moderate in terms of the type of income he'll earn from himself, etc. But because he'll be limited to just the areas which are accessible Islamically.
So you said that
social worker? Social worker also. Sure. Same thing. Because, you know, what's happening in the right now, for example, here in Birmingham, I met one brother here who's doing social work, right? You know, he's studying it. And, you know, he is going in, because you have problems which exist in the Muslim community, especially amongst the, you know, the immigrant Muslim community from Muslim countries, etc. They have many problems that are arising. Their children are, you know, going into kufr here and there, and, you know, and one guy just killed his two daughters, you know, killed himself, you know, and just recently here, right? You know, and this is happening in America, it's happening. So people need, there needs to be a system, you know, of counseling and this type of thing to help people to deal with the problems that are arising, you know, marital problems and things which occur, which explode and lead into, you know, major problems in the society, etc. You know, there needs to be people who have gained some kind of knowledge and skill in that system. Also, from the point of view that the social working system is functioning right now, where children, you know, from Muslim families are being put into foster homes of Christians and this type of thing, it's very important that people are involved in that process who can help to direct them, those children, over into Muslim families, you know, to utilize the benefits of that system for the benefit of the Muslim community. Because right now, you know, the Muslim community is suffering severely in that field.
You said
the Prophet Muhammad, clip the nails back in the day.
Did that, like, scissors?
Well, scissors are not something which is new, actually. You know, they found scissors amongst the Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, right? So it's not something new per se. But the actually the term used in Arabic is, how did they clip the hair? You know, I mean, whatever technique they use is different from shaving, right? You know, it's different from shaving. And in the cutting of the hair, they may have used like a comb and then a knife, a sharp knife, and just cut off the extra hair that was above the comb, you know? And with the, for the clipping of the nail, the cutting, really, it's really cutting the nail, you know? It was, we think of clipping, it's something that makes a clip, like a clipper, right? They, of course, like, they didn't have that then, the clipper that we know of, right? But they had scissors, and, you could use a knife, you know, people use a very sharp knife, you can cut your fingernails using a sharp knife. But it's not to say that because they only used a sharp knife in those days to cut the nails, it's haram now to buy a clipper and clip your nails. No. It's again going to another extreme, right? You know, technology here doesn't, we're not, Islamically, not obliged to give up technology because of the fact that it wasn't used by Prophet Muhammad. So whatever fulfills that purpose, right, you know, we look at Prophet asked us to do something, whatever means that we use to do that, to end up with that same end result, as long as it's within halal, it is acceptable, you know, and technology will improve, you know, improve different ways and means of doing these things.
Okay.
enough.
I was thinking of really just the host and a couple months in the country, and then they have come to realize how they used to live in those days. Because a lot of these things they don't have. You'd be surprised, you know what I mean, how you get around them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was a kid, I didn't know about kissers, I didn't know about, you know what I mean, scissors, comb, yes, I mean, but it's very automatic, scissors, then you want a scissors, you know what I mean, you know what I mean, that's just someone for a barber, or something, or a soul, or a woman that soul, so that's it, it's not a common thing, and you just get by without having those things, you know, so going back to the radio, and something else, and there are ways, I mean, of, you know what I mean, surviving. And it's probably better than what we have today now. You know, we take everything for granted and we can't do without it. We get in that frame of mind, you know. That's why Islam, I think, is getting weak. You know, I mean, people just sit back and just accept everything that's going on because they don't willing to make the effort to really, I wouldn't say go back, but appreciate what they have. You know, I mean, they're always looking for something simple, something to make them generally more aware or be noticed, if you know what I mean. Not being subtle,
but the idea of simplicity, though, you see, it was noted that the Prophet Muhammad, whenever he was given the choice between two things, both of which were halal, he would take the easier one. Okay, this was the way of the Prophet. So there's nothing wrong with us developing or using simple ways of fulfilling some of our needs. There's nothing wrong with that, really. You know, I mean, what we need is really to establish our Islam, you know, to apply it. Yes, to apply it. And I mean, we will use from the society what is useful and what is harmful, and that, you know, we need that, you know. Mortgage. Yes, and in my view, brother, you know, based on the clear prohibitions in the Quran, you know, and the Sunnah concerning dealings with interest, the mortgage system as we know it now, you see, there is a way within Islamic banking to do mortgages, which would be acceptable Islamically. But where there is no Islamic banking, for one to go into the existing system and then enter into an interest deal where you sign and pay interest, no, this would be haram, unless your life or your limb is threatened. You see, if you have no means of putting a roof over your head, this is the only way which remains for you. You cannot rent a place, whatever. You know, this is all that is left for you. And then this is not really the case. But if that circumstance, a closer circumstance, arose, then you would be allowed to be of an interest to that degree. Just to the degree of providing for that particular need. If your workplace is so far away, it's the only job you have to feed your mouth, your family, and you have to drive to get there, that's the only way to do it. And to drive, you must have car insurance. Then, given that circumstance, you have no other choice but to feed your family, etc., so you pay the insurance to that degree. But you don't say, well, because I have to pay this insurance for the car, I may as well, you know, get the mortgage on the house, and, you know, they go to the bank, and, you know, you just, the user is now the open door to do everything else. No, whatever is within this system, you know, we may be permitted to do some of the prohibited things within the system just to the degree that it is necessary to fulfill a basic need that we must have fulfilled. Well, if it's possible to sell the house and get out of the mortgage, then that's best. If it's only a little bit remaining, you accept to change into Islam, for example, or you came to that realization, you know, then, you know, you may borrow money, whatever, from Muslims and pay off the thing and just finish the thing and carry on from there. You know, it depends on your situation. But if you have, you know, still, you know, you have 10 more years of paying of the interest, and you know it's haram for you to just sit on that, to be haram for yourself. This is for you to sell it off, get the money, and, you know, try to reinvest it some other way to provide that need for yourself. And I know there, you know, there has been fatwas given which make the allowance for mortgage in these circumstances, you know, just a general allowance given because you're not in an Islamic country, you can. But you see, we have to be very careful of these things because You see, when we have a clear prohibition by Allah and His Messenger, you know, and then we have a person coming to you giving you all these logical arguments, you see, you have to be very careful if you're going to leave what is clear and obvious to you, obviously prohibited, and go with what, you know, suits your desires, you know, from logic. You have to be very careful.
There's a problem with money, I mean, if you can't produce that, does that mean you have to have that?
No. No, but you see, if you put it in a checking account, you know, checking account, you are not receiving interest. They don't give you interest. Savings accounts give you interest. But a checking account doesn't give you interest. The money is there, you can use checks to get your money out, it's just a means of holding your money for you. I mean, of course, this is still, you know, Islamically speaking, it is only acceptable because you have no other place to put your money, you know, because even putting your money in the bank is helping the bank, you know, and Islamically speaking, you shouldn't be helping a prohibited system. However, you know, we can say that is a minimum, you know, that you can do for, because to leave your money in your house, people, you know, may break in your home and, you know, this will create greater problems for you. You do that lesser evil, which is putting your money in the bank and not taking interest, you know, as a means of, you know, protecting your family in that sense.
I was trying to do some bank documents in accounts with interest as well. But if you're full of
some checking accounts also with interest.
So you have to specific when you go to freedom. You can do what you want. You can go to a small fee, a hundred million, you know, on the account that you want. But on the other one, if you have so much money, you can start type interest on it, you don't want that. And what he's saying, you know, I've got no other way. With my work, they pay directly to a matching account, you know, and so. There's no shit going on, you know, I mean, there's a lot of mafia, but they don't have any money, you know. But, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, from that, you know, to my memory, you won't have that much money in here anyway. They should also give them a chance to work on it, you know.
Well, of the classical tafsirs, we know that Tabari has been a part of the Surah Al-Baqarah has been translated into English, you know, by one of the brothers, Muslim brothers, I think in Cambridge or Oxford, I don't know, I'm not sure which one, but it's already out in hardback, you know. However, though Tafsir al-Tabari is the oldest tafsir available to us, and basically all of the later tafsirs ended up referring back to Tabari and benefiting from the work of Imam Tabari. At the same time, Imam Tabari's methodology for tafsir was such that the average person, if he tries to read this, he will be lost. He will be lost. Because Imam Tabari was a teacher. You know, he taught students. He had, and what he did was when he took a particular verse, he would give you all of the different statements that people had to say about it. He would give you a whole range from statements which were fabricated to weak to, you know, based on, you know, from Jewish traditions, you know, a whole range of statements, one after the other, some contradicting, you know, directly contradicting. So he gave you the whole range. And his students would then, in the course of discussion, you know, sift out that which was really the best interpretation of this verse. Now, what I'm saying is that as it exists even in Arabic, the average person, when he picks up Tafsir Tabari in Arabic, he's lost. He's lost. Can't understand. When it was translated into English, the translator also conveyed the various opinions. So if you pick it up and try to read it, and to determine what is right and, you know, what is the actual tafsir of the verse, you'll find, I mean, I'm sure it is available around here, maybe IPCI or whatever has a copy of it. You pick it and read it. And I'm not saying don't read it, you pick it up and read it. But I'm saying this is what you can expect to find. It is not, practically speaking, though it is a classic, it is not, a practical book to read in Tafsir, if you want to read Tafsir. There is, and there are those available in English. We have the 30th part, which has been, you know, from, say, it's Kutub Tafsir of the Quran, Shirah of the Quran. This one has been around for some time. We have the Tafsir of Maududi, translated, you know, into English. This is one of the few complete tafsirs which is available. They have limitations. I'm not saying that, you know, Tafsir Maududi is it, you know, this is the most reliable. No, it's what is available. He has got a lot of information there. Unfortunately, you know, Maududi himself, Maulana Maududi, was not a scholar of hadith. So he brought narrations as he came across them from the various books. So you will find that he will use for interpretations some narrations which are not authentic. You know, this became particularly evident to me when I was I was trying to prepare a tafsir on Surah Yasin, because Surah Yasin is one of the favorite, you know, surahs for the Muslim world, you know, especially for Muslim world in general, because people just become, Surah Yasin has become like the most important surah in the Quran. They read it for people who are dying, they read it for people when they're born, they read it, you know, it's used all over the place like an amulet, special amulet from the Quran, Surah Yasin, right? People call themselves Yasin, you know. So this surah, because it's been so abused, you know, what I did was I went and I looked up the various hadiths which are related to the surah, you know, which made claims for it. If you read it so many times, you know, all your sins are gone, and you read it for this person's dying, he's going to paradise, and all kinds of, you know, special merits for surah Yasin. And a vast majority of the material was, you know, fabricated or extremely weak, you know. So after I'd gone through and identified this thing, I just, out of curiosity, went to Maududi's tafsir to see, you know, what he did with these traditions. Did he use them or what? So when I went in there, I opened up, you know, to my surprise, I found that he was using these traditions, you know, concerning reading it for those who are dying and this type of thing, and they were not authentic traditions that he brings at the beginning of this tafsir, so yeah, I think he brings them, you know, and the vast majority of them were not reliable. So it means that though it is the only one which is available complete in terms of the whole Quran, I mean, one has to read it and still check back on the sources to the degree that they can. You know, material which is traced back to Bukhari and Muslim, obviously authentic, you know, you can rely on. Other statements made, you know, if there are other scholars available in the vicinity, in your locality, whatever, you try to ask and check about the reliability of the material. Yeah, okay, this is, this was supposed to have been a combination of the tafsirs of Ibn Kathir and Al-Qurtubi, I believe. You know, they had taken portions out of this. It's incomplete. But this is something which is, because you'll find they will make references to hadith in Bukhari and Muslim, you know, trying to stay within that which are authentic. But and that is a fairly reliable text. So. And, you know, there are other pieces, you know, which have been, you know, done by other scholars, etc. But and there is a major project going on right now in the United States. One brother Egyptian scholar by the name of Ahmed Zaki, he has got a Quran project on where he is taking, he and a group of people are in the process of trying to make a tafsir for the Quran based on the classics, you know, Tabari and Qurtubi and Ibn Kathir and others. They're preparing one now. It's a major project going on, which is, you know, full-time project. So hopefully in the not-too-distant future something, you know, will come out in that field, which may be more reliable than what is available today. To be called Muhammad. Oh, yes, certainly. It's permissible, perfectly. You know, you see, the name Muhammad, the name itself existed in the time of the Prophet Muhammad. I know commonly it is said that this was the only, he was the only person by that name. But there are other narrations which indicate there were some other people who also had that name. You know, and after his time, there is amongst the Sahaba who had the name Muhammad, you know, and amongst the Tabi'in, and there have been Muslim scholars, you know, that, through the centuries who have taken that name. So, and see, for it not to become permissible, we would have to actually have a statement of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam wherein he said that we should not take that name. You know, what he did say was that one should not take his name and his kunya. That is, he was known as Muhammad, he was Abu Qasim. This was his kunya, right? The father of Al-Qasim, the son he named Al-Qasim. So it's not allowable for us to take both his name and his kunya. But to take his kunya without his name, to take his name without his kunya, perfectly okay.
And what's the ruling on
See, the spiritual aspect of Islam is very important. You know, Islam, because we as human beings are both spiritual and material, I mean, we cannot say that we put all our efforts into that which relates to our material world and we neglect the spiritual aspect. Because, in fact, the spiritual aspect ultimately becomes even the greater and more important aspect. Our physical body goes away, the spirit lives on, right? So, that which develops the spirit and helps the spirit to grow and to improve, etc., is very, very important, you know? Whenever people give full consideration to that and neglect the material aspect, they deviate. Whenever they give full importance to the material aspect and neglect the spiritual, they deviate. You know, that whatever of Islam, for it to be correct, it must have both aspects to it, you know? That this is, you know, this is that middle path where everything is combined. Islam is, it has both aspects to it, not how we should approach our Islam. You know, the issue of, that you mentioned in terms of Wahhabi, etc., you know, of course, I mean, ultimately what a person has to do is he has to seek Islam, you know, based on the Quran and the Sunnah, you know, which was based on revelation what came to us. What he finds is close to it, or seems to be following it, that's what he goes by. What he finds does not seem to be following it, he avoids. You know, people will put all kinds of labels on whatever they don't like, you know, and pronounce to be deviant if they don't like it, you know. And so when we go and we hear a person, for example, refers to something as deviant or whatever, whether it's me or anybody, you know, we have to look ultimately to see what is the basis of saying this thing is deviant, right? Because what I consider deviant considers me deviant, right? So you on the outside, you hear me refer to that person or that particular thought as deviant, that thought is referred to me as deviant. So now you have to judge for yourself. I mean, your judgment shouldn't be because you like me, you like the way I talk, you know? I seem like a real nice guy, because the other people seem to be harsh and whatever, so you don't like them, so you're going to accept what I'm saying and not accept. No, that shouldn't be your criterion. Your criterion should be, what is the basis of what I'm saying? If it's based on Quran and Sunnah, if it seems to be linked to the basis of Islam, then this is what makes it acceptable to you. If what they're saying is not based on Quran, so our tradition, we always used to do it, you know, we went to the graves and that's what our grandparents did, our great-grandparents did, anybody who doesn't want to do it is a Wahhabi deviant, whatever. You know, if you see that their arguments are just based on culture, there's no Quran to support it, you know, no Sunnah to support it, then you reject it on that basis. You know, and that's how we have to treat everything. Everybody is capable of error. You know, no matter how hard a person may study, you know, how much knowledge he may gather, whatever, he still is capable of making error. So you don't accept whatever anybody says just because they said so, because he is so-and-so, he's giving this title or whatever. It's always, you have to go back and try to refer as much as possible to Quran and Sunnah, you know, to the early scholars of Islam, and try to determine as best as you can what is correct, you know, and avoid what is not correct. And because a person may make an error in a particular thing, you know, again, we shouldn't necessarily reject that person because he said this position, I fucked.